Welcome to the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm Bo, and I'm joined today by Apostolic Majesty. AM, how are you?
Hello, I'm very happy to be here and to be returning as a guest again. It's a great honour. Thank you very much.
No, it's great to have you. And this time we're going to be talking about, it will be a series of videos on the origins of World War One, which is a massive, massive topic. I mean, it's really most of 19th century European politics in one way or another, isn't it? And so one of the first things I wanted to ask you is, and I want to give you a free hand to talk about really more or less within reason, whatever you like. I wonder where exactly you'd like to start, because of course you could go back to sort of 1815 or the very end of the Napoleonic era if you wanted to. Well, there's all sorts of big events, aren't there? Sort of the unrest of the 1840s, or perhaps the Prussian-Austrian War of the 60s, and of course the Franco-Prussian War of the 1870s. I'm sure we'll talk about that, and whether you want to have a bit of Franz Joseph, a bit of Bismarck, all sorts of things. So I'll throw it over to you. Where do you think would be a good place to start with this?
Great. Well, I think just working this back and trying to make people understand my logic when doing this. When encountering the causes for World War One, it's probably the most historiographically butchered topic there is out there among many. There is no sort of satisfying consensus, historical consensus when it comes to the causes of World War One. So as to how to deal with a particular start for the various causes of World War One, there are many, you know, certain dates. So for example, people tend to, relay this around the 1880s, when we see, you know, the decline of Bismarck's authority, when we see the Berlin Congress system, when we see the beginning of the alliance system, the beginning of, you know, military buildup, what have you. But I want to take this all the way back, as you said. You said we could begin this after the Napoleonic period. But I think just to understand, you know, what that essentially means. So we're going back to 1815. 1815 is the year when Napoleon, of course, was deposed a second time after the decisive Battle of Waterloo, and he was exiled to St. Helena in the middle of the South Atlantic Ocean. Just to put in context before then, obviously we have the French Revolution in 1789. And from 1789 until 1799, France becomes embroiled in a series of escalating conflicts with virtually every other major power in Europe. And by 1799, Napoleon has taken over France as consul and later emperor of the French in 1804. And by 1812, the imperial French revolutionary regime has more or less united all of continental Europe. The borders of the French Empire are now at the river Niemen in what is now Lithuania. The French have an ongoing conflict in Spain and trying to subdue Portugal. They have forced all the various great powers in continental Europe, so for example, Prussia, Austria, into alliance, but they have failed to subdue Russia, alas, and of course Great Britain. Inviting their doom. We have the disastrous campaign of 1812, the subsequent rollback of all of Napoleon's conquests. And now in 1814, 1815, we have the Congress of Vienna to deal with the significant aftermath of the conflict. Now, what really arises out of that conflict for the purposes of our conversation of the direct causes of World War One is delineating the you can say the significance of, you know, 19th century, you know, European foreign policy compared to every century that preceded it. The 18th century was a very violent century. The 17th century was comparatively more so. We have, you know, one of the great, European conflicts. The 30 Years' War was responsible for killing people in the millions, as was the case with the Napoleonic Wars, which is really the cap-off to the, we consider a long version of the 18th century, which ends in 1815. But the remarkable result of the Congress is this commitment to the idea of the peace of Europe. There is going to be, unlike the Napoleonic system, where you envisage one major power, in this case France, dominating all of the other nations in Europe. And more or less, you can see this as a proto-form of the European Union, albeit relatively, you know, far more centralized. Had, you know, Napoleon realized his dream of creating a European empire under Paris. And what is remarkable is that there is a commitment to peace, but it isn't based on the supremacy of any European power. Rather, it is based on the idea that collectively all the nations, all the great powers of Europe, so this would be Great Britain, France, and again, another significant aspect of the treaty of the Congress of Vienna is that France, despite being the aggressor in the Napoleonic conflicts, is rehabilitated. There is regime change in France. The Bonapartes are gone. The Bourbon dynasty, so in this case, the old kings who were there before the French Revolution come back, and they are reconciled and they are allowed to become part of this new continental system. Together with that, we have Prussia, which will later become the German Empire, or rather it'll become the leading member of the German Empire. There is, of course, Russia, the Russian Empire, which is much larger than the Russia we know today. And then, of course, there is right in the middle of this, the Austrian Empire, the remnant of the Habsburg domains, the leftover of the Holy Roman Empire, which have been dissolved in the process of the Napoleonic Wars. So together we have all of these powers holding up this idea of the peace of Europe. But more so, there is this commitment to undoing the legacy of the French Revolution and trying to maintain some sort of consistent social and political order founded in reaction to the ideas of the French Revolution. So more or less restoring the idea of throne and altar, the primacy of the Christian faith, because, of course, all of these nations have different religions. You know, France and Austria are Catholic. Prussia is Lutheran with Calvinist elements. Russia, of course, is Orthodox. And Britain is Anglican, so Christian, but not of any one particular denomination. And, you know, why does the system fail? You know, on the one hand, you can say that the Congress system inaugurated what you can see as one of the longest periods of European peace. In terms of Europeans actually fighting each other, one of the first instances is in the Crimean War in the 1850s. So to put this in perspective, from 1815 until the 1850s, there isn't an instant where two major European powers actually fighting against each other, which is remarkable considering the situation in the previous centuries. And then, of course, you have the Italian Wars of Unification and the Prussian Wars of Unification. So really, that's a testament to the success of the system. However, the system is already being undermined and on the verge of collapse way before then. So I mentioned the fact that this whole system is based on the collaboration of many different great powers rather than the domineering presence of a single great power. So Austria plays the leading diplomatic role in this position under the auspices of the great chancellor, of the great imperial chancellor Clemens von Metternich. And the way to essentially organize, you know, Europe's affairs is through the system called the Congress. So continuing on the Congress of Vienna, we have the Congress of Laibach, the Congress of Troppau, the Congresses of Verona, to try and deal with various issues affecting the order of Europe. One such thing that arises out of the system is a proto form of collective security, but it's not collective security in the sense that would later be, we would see in the League of Nations or the United Nations. Rather, this is foreign intervention to ensure that one nation in Europe isn't subverted by the ideas of the French Revolution. And the Congress system really breaks down around 1822, where you have the death of the domineering presence of British foreign policy, Viscount Casterly. He commits suicide, it should be noted, mainly due to his considerable lack of popularity in Britain owing to his rather conservative policies. And there is this desire to intervene in Spain, which during the 19th century is really a powder keg, which is often, you know, not very much mentioned. And Britain essentially has intractable differences with the council. And after 1822, Britain becomes essentially detached under, you know, George Canning, with its own foreign policy, which obviously plays a significant role in terms of how we view Britain over the next century. At the same time, Russia is wanting to expand its influence at the expense of the Ottoman Empire. And again, this is another major thing we'll talk about. The entirety of the Balkans, more or less, was under the control of a single power at the beginning of this time period, the Ottoman Empire. And as we'll see, as we get towards 1914, that entire idea of the Ottoman Empire, you know, being this supreme power in the Balkans, completely unravels. In 1815, the Ottomans control everything from Bosnia to Greece to nominal headship over Romania. By 1914, the Ottomans only control essentially the borders they have now, the borders of Turkey, so the cities of Edirne and Istanbul, Constantinople, to make this all the more remarkable. So we have one great power, which is already beginning to disintegrate throughout the process of the 19th century. And a lot of the conflicts stemming around the 19th century, especially the Crimean War, are dealing with the fact that the Ottoman Empire is now essentially moribund, is entering into this period of terminal decline. So that, again, is a major reason for the breakdown of this Congress system. Another reason for the major breakdown of the Congress system is the fact that this overriding cause to suppress the ideas of the French Revolution and to ensure there is some sort of conservative reactionary consensus among all the nations of Europe, principally the great powers. If the great powers are not in alignment with this policy, then this whole policy is going to break down. France becomes the first nation to be majorly subverted when in 1830 we have the revolution in France, which gets rid of the Bourbons and replaces it with a sort of pseudo revolutionary sort of ersatz monarchy under the Orleanists, under Louis Philippe, whose father played a leading role in the events of the French Revolution as Philippe Galate. And then, of course, we have the for our purposes, we have the Belgian Revolution, which, of course, Belgium had been part of Austria. It had then been forced to become part of the Netherlands, as one, you know, greater United Netherlands with Luxembourg, Belgium, and the Netherlands as one nation. In 1830, we have the Belgian Revolution. And the result of this essentially is Britain having the overriding influence and creating an independent state of Belgium, which from 1830 to 1839, the idea is that Britain will essentially act as the political guarantor of the Belgian nation, again, subverting the system which had been created in 1815.
Was that mainly just to deny it to France?
There are many reasons. It's rather sort of a novel case here because Belgium, as you probably know, used to be a profoundly Catholic country. It also has a significant Francophone influence, as you've alluded to. Half the country is essentially French speaking. The West is the north is essentially Dutch, Flemish speaking. And the situation with that is that it was essentially the rump of the Spanish Netherlands, which didn't become part of the Dutch Republic. It became part then of the Austrian Empire. And then the Austrians spent the latter part of the 18th century trying to give it to someone else because they didn't want to deal with the headache of having a border along France, which was constantly invading it and, in fact, occupied it at various points during the 18th century. And indeed, it did occupy it during the French Revolution and annex it to the French Republic. So when the area was, you know, taken back from France in 1813, 1814, and confirmed by 1815, we have this novel idea of wedding it to the Dutch Republic for the sake of essentially allowing Austria not to take over that territory again, as it has so desperately tried to get rid of it in the 18th century. However, you're now in this awkward situation whereby all of these Catholics are now under the control of an unpopular, seen as very, very much autocratic Protestant monarch in the north. In terms of, did the French want to annex it? Yes, there was a plan advocated by Maurice Talleyrand, one of the recurring figures throughout the French Revolution, who served many regimes, called the Talleyrand Plan, which would have essentially split influence in what was now Belgium between France and Britain. Britain would have had control over the city of Antwerp. And France would have come to control Wallonia, which, of course, is the French influence, the French speaking part of Belgium.
Good old Talleyrand. He always gets in there somewhere, isn't he? He comes up again and again and again.
Yes,
it's quite a valuable bit of land there, isn't it? There's quite a lot of industry there in Belgium, relatively speaking. So it is coveted, isn't it?
Well, I think that's quite an interesting, because a lot of the conversations regarding the causes of World War One tend to focus on, I think this is a very unhelpful way of dealing about the causes of World War One, which is dealing with the issue of guilt. All nations in World War One were culpable. I don't believe it's necessarily of any interest to try and assign particular or special guilt in this regard, but it definitely was. I mean, France was, this really needs to be emphasized. In 1812, France was not just the leading power in Europe. France potentially could have united Europe under its own auspices, and it became very close. I mean, I'm not sure whether you can feature maps on this podcast at all, but just looking at the size of the French Empire and its subjugated allies, which, you know, included in that France controlled essentially all of Italy, with the exception of Sicily and Sardinia. They controlled Germany. Half of Germany essentially have been, you know, all the way up from Oldenburg to Lübeck, the Netherlands, the West Bank of the Rhine. All of these areas have been annexed directly to France. And the rest of Germany have been essentially consolidated under these smaller states as part of something called the Rhinebund, or the Confederation of the Rhine. And once we see the unraveling of the system, France becomes, for the first time in a very long time, a second-rate power in European affairs, which is really remarkable, considering that throughout the 18th century, even though France didn't have the same territory as the Napoleonic Empire, France was still very much considered to be the first nation of Europe in terms of the prestige of the Court of Versailles, in terms of its population. It had around, I think, 25 million people at the outset of the French Revolution. And of course, it was the largest state in Europe, saving, of course, the Russian Empire. So what is remarkable is that by 1815, France is now playing second fiddle in international affairs, in maritime affairs to Britain, and in continental affairs to Russia, Austria, and Prussia. Russia, as it stands, is now seen as the dominant military power in Europe, completely taking away that mantle from France. So yes, what we see with Talleyrand and the Talleyrand Plan over Belgium is some attempt to try and rescue some form of power back to France and try and repatriate some of those territories, which were part of this, you know, greater Napoleonic French Revolutionary France. And as you say, you know, the major implications of that were the industrial capacity of Belgium. Belgium would only really begin to industrialize in the 1840s, you know, under the auspices of its new Saxe-Coburg monarch, who was essentially imported to stabilize the new country.
I've got a few questions here, AM. It's very, very dense. Lots of stuff there in just a few minutes. Lots and lots of, well, many years worth of history skating over there. A couple of questions, little things really, clarifying things. One thing you said in the Napoleonic period, being united under Paris, or you mentioned Versailles there, the Court of Versailles. Was it not that, correct me if I'm wrong, did Napoleon not have his sort of seat of power at Fontainebleau? Is that wrong? Or is that right? Or was that his military headquarters?
Yes. Just to emphasize this, when I say Versailles, I was talking about pre-1789.
Right.
When I was talking about Paris, yes, Fontainebleau was one of the principal courts of Napoleon, just outside of Paris, but also one of his principal residences was the Tuileries Palace, which was formerly adjacent to the Louvre, which was then destroyed.
So right in the middle there. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is Castlereagh. I think you pronounced that a bit differently. How did you pronounce it? Our foreign secretary?
I think I did try and pronounce it that way, unless I something model.
Because I find him really interesting, and I know a fair bit about sort of, you know, our foreign policy, and you know, you could make the argument that he was among the most powerful men in the world for a while there, in a sense, anyway. But I know that he did kill himself, sadly. But I'm not really sure exactly why. I've never sort of read an essay or listened to a lecture that really went into any detail about that. Just a minute or two on that. Do you know why that would have been? You said, you mentioned, because he was sort of politically out of favour.
In terms,
got any detail on that?
In terms of the, I wasn't anticipating this.
Sorry, if you don't know, it's fine. Of course, I mean.
In terms of the political, I can't really go into the personal life of Castlereagh because I don't know him. I don't know him well enough. But in terms of the political implications of Castlereagh, I will just mention that he was seen as an anomaly when we're talking about Britain as a maritime empire. And after Castlereagh, we talk about Britain entering into this period of splendid isolation even though that period is only going to, you know, really going to be, you know, apply to the period of Lord Salisbury later in the 1880s, Castlereagh is noted because he envisages Britain as actively participating in this, you know, new conservative order in Europe as part of the Congress system, and therefore taking part within the internal interventions to prevent the French Revolution popping up in various countries. What makes Castlereagh so significant in this regard is that that is at complete odds when he commits suicide with all, you know, subsequent, you know, British foreign policy initiatives. If anything, Britain becomes one of the most subversive forces when it comes to undermining that continental system. Yeah. Because Britain, as you know, after 1832, after, you know, more or less this was done in reaction to the 1830 revolution in France, we have the 1832 Great Reform Act. Mm. And from 1832, really up until Disraeli's Great Reform Act of 1867, there is a period of Whig ascendancy, and the Whigs are very much anti this notion of, you know, for example, standing up for the sake of censorship for the what they would consider to be the autocratic reactionary Christian monarchies of Europe. And so Britain plays, you know, a leading role, for example, in the, you know, revolutions in Portugal, in the revolutions in, you know, in Brazil. I know this is going way beyond our conversation, but of mm-hmm. course, in the revolutions in Spain, and of course, you know, agitating possibly for, you know, Italian unification, because after the Napoleonic Wars, Italy, it's interesting, Italy had essentially been occupied in the north by France. There was a line drawn around the River Po, you know, including Tuscany and Lazio, the region around Rome, was directly annexed by France. The rest of it was part of this Napoleonic Kingdom of Italy, which was technically also Napoleon's, but run by his stepson, Eugene de Beauharnais. When the Austrians come back in, the Austrians establish a form of, you know, hegemony over Italy. They take over, or rather reassert their control over the area around Venice, Veneto, Lombardy. The Pope is restored in the Papal States. In the south, we have the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, so essentially Sicily and the area around Naples, most of southern Italy, is united under a monarch. And then, of course, we have the Kingdom of Sardinia, Savoy, which is going to play a key part in the Wars of Italian Unification. But Britain begins, especially under Viscount Palmerston, prevaricating towards this idea of, you know, supporting Italian unification, supporting Mazzini and the various young Europeans, which will later play a major role in the revolutions of 1848, if you want to get onto that.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.